Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join My Lowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
So I think when all the evidence is considered, the materialist idea that the mind produces the brain has been proven false, scientifically proven false.
Chris Carter, educated in Oxford, England. Previous work includes Science and the Near-Death Experience, Science and Psychic Phenomena, and Science and the Afterlife Experience. We're talking about the newest one, The Case for the Afterlife, and this is Evidence of Life After Death. Evidence, science, all at this point fresh and current. How did you get started?
Well, Wendy, thanks for having me on the show. I suppose it all started when I was a student, and one of my fellow students, we were living in a college dorm in England, and he invited me to join him and two other graduate students to spend our next year living in a farmhouse, which lay just outside of town and was owned by a college. I wasn't sure if I wanted to spend my next year living on this farmhouse because in the residence, it was much closer to town than college, much more convenient, especially since I was an expat student from Canada. He told me that the place had a ghost, and that caught my attention. And so I decided to visit and see the place for myself. And while I was there, I stopped in to speak to the college carpenter at his workshop on the farm. After a brief chat, I came straight out with it. I said, "I hear the place is haunted." And he said, "Well, I don't know myself, but the carpenter before me, he swore the place was haunted." And well, that was enough for me. I decided to move in and spend the next year living in this allegedly haunted farmhouse. To make a long story short, I did see and hear things which I could not readily explain, which did not fit in very well with the materialist opinions of some of the philosophers I'd studied, but yet I was open enough to admit that perhaps these things were really what they seemed to be, the lingering disembodied presence of someone who had lived in the house in days long past. Anyway, those experiences are nothing particular or dramatic. My books are not about my personal experiences, but these experiences did spark my interest, and when I returned to Canada, I decided to see if any serious research had been done on the subjects of haunting, alleged communication with the departed. On a visit to the local library, I was surprised to find a great deal of research. Serious research had been done, dating back well over a century. I was particularly impressed by the work of the British and American Societies for Psychical Research. They were both founded in the 1880s. The British Society was founded first, I believe 1882, by Henry Sidgwick, who was a philosopher at Cambridge University. 2 years later, in 1884, the American Society was founded by William James, the renowned philosopher from Harvard University. And the members at the time, they included some of the most elite scientists and philosophers and physicians, lawyers and scholars on both sides of the Atlantic. And these organizations worked very closely together, despite the gap of the Atlantic Ocean. They published an enormous amount of research and writing, which was very impressive, despite the often repeated lie that the British and American Societies for Psychical Research found nothing. Simple fact of the matter is their research fills two enormous libraries, and the research was good enough and convincing enough to change the opinions of even those members who started off as diehard skeptics. And I talk about this in my book. I mentioned research by people such as the American SPR member Richard Hodgson. He was a lawyer, and he started off as a diehard skeptic. He started off debunk mediums. Well, after one of his friends perished in New York after an accident at the age of 32, messages from this fellow began to come through, and they convinced even him. And he said, he admitted, "I was wrong. I'm now fully convinced." So the evidence was strong enough by the beginning of the 20th century to convince almost all of leading members of the British and American Societies for Psychical Research that survival was genuine. And after the members themselves began to depart this world, messages from them began to come through, often to the very same mediums that they investigated themselves. and in some cases try so hard to debunk. These messages are considered some of the most evidential of all, because if you think about it, if they are what they say they are, what they purport to be, then they are messages coming from people who are very familiar with all the problems, the objections, the difficulties. So it should be no surprise that some of the best evidence seems to have come from departed members of the original British and American Society of Psychical Research.
No matter how much evidence, how much research, how much science there is in the database, there is still a mainstream rejection of this evidence. Have you figured out why that might be?
Yeah, absolutely. Essentially, the objections are not scientific. They're not even philosophical. The objections are essentially ideological. You have to remember that most of the so-called skeptics, the Paul Kurtz, James Alcock, and so forth, James Randi, most of them are militant atheists. I mean, Paul Kurtz was the founder of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. I mean, he started out writing pamphlets supporting atheism. And many of the leading members of this so-called skeptical organization have been avowed atheists, as I said. Paul Kurtz, James Alcock, James Randi, and many others. Stephen Jay Gould. Their motivation is essentially ideological. One of the fundamental pillars of the atheistic worldview is the doctrine of materialism. And that's the ancient idea that all events have a material cause, and that therefore the mind is produced by the brain. Any evidence to the contrary obviously threatens or removes this pillar. The pillar of materialism threatens the collapse of this entire worldview. This, I argue, more than anything else, explains their militant and stubborn opposition to the evidence. They simply follow a policy of scorched earth and simply deny everything.
I'm familiar with James Randi. And my issue with his research or alleged research is that any time something was questionable and might be seen as valid, he changed the goalpost.
Yeah, it's called a shifting goalpost. Just move the goalpost back a few meters and keep on doing that.
You address in the book, Rupert Sheldrake, memories stored in the brain. And he says, no, that there's no proof that it's stored in the brain.
Sheldrake is a renegade English biologist. He's a friend of mine. No, there's none whatsoever. That's an article of materialistic faith. That's far from being a fact. As a matter of fact, the evidence indicates exactly the opposite. All attempts to localize memory traces in the brain using animals, such as chickens and octopus and so forth, have failed and failed miserably. And not only that, but following brain damage, any sort of brain damage, memories frequently return. And then, of course, we have the evidence of terminal lucidity. There are many documented cases in which a person with severe dementia, Alzheimer's, some sort of other brain impairment, suddenly gains full lucidity and clarity of thought in the last few days or hours of life. These cases were even known in ancient times. Hippocrates wrote of them, others, and it was always interpreted as the mind or the soul disengaging in final moments of life from the restrictions of material brain. And so the evidence seems to indicate not that the brain produces the mind, but rather that the brain acts as a two-way receiver-transmitter for the mind. So sometimes from body to mind as a sense perception, and other times from mind to body as in willed action. And I argue very strongly in my book, it's not even necessary to consider phenomena such as the near-death experience or what have you, or deathbed visions in order to come to this conclusion. Again, there's the example of terminal lucidity and the experiment and the failed attempts to memorize localized memory traces. So I think when all the evidence is considered, the materialist idea that the mind produces the brain has been proven false, scientifically proven false. And the problem with the materialists, the militant atheists, is that they simply refuse to accept this. This is contrary to their central dogma.
it's very difficult for me to use this language because the scientific stuff doesn't work for me. I've had my own experiences, so it's difficult for me to get out of that and just be objective the way you are. That's why I like your work, because it is science-based.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I mean, this is a problem really at the intersection of science and philosophy. It's where the two crossroads meet. There are scientific aspects of the problem. There's also philosophical problems, such as what we just discussed, which is known as the mind-brain problem in philosophy. You know, what is the relationship between the mind and the brain? Obviously, science has a role to play in this, and I just mentioned some examples of terminal lucidity from medical research. And again, these cases were known even in ancient times. My book, The Case for the Afterlife, is essentially a tightly focused critique of, well, it's an exposition of the evidence for the afterlife, but it's more than that. It's a tightly focused critique of the alternative explanations offered by mostly militant skeptics, but also other people themselves who are not, other scientists and philosophers who are not familiar with the evidence. And so I consider the usual suspects of fraud, mistaken eyewitness testimony, incompetence on the part of the researcher, and these are easily dealt with. The most intractable of the objections is the so-called super ESP objection. And that's the idea that this evidence can be explained in terms of some combination of telepathy and clairvoyance. This was proposed over a century ago. That's when a British reverend, just looking this up right now, Drayton Thomas, what he did was he invented something called proxy sitting. He was testing the hypothesis that extrasensory perception between the medium and the sitter, who in most cases knew the deceased, was responsible for the accurate information the medium was providing. And so in a proxy sitting, a third party sits in place of the usual person. That's someone who has no connection to the deceased. In most cases, it was Reverend Thomas himself. And a skeptical philosopher brought him, wanted to test this. He was convinced it was just all due to telepathy. So he gave Thomas, I think, two facts, the name and the date of death of the deceased. So the sitting was not even secondhand, it was third hand because it was through this intermediary philosopher. Anyway, Thomas sat down with the medium, knowing nothing, next to nothing about this departed person, apart from their name and the date of their death. Within moments, messages purporting to come from this person came through, and the so-called skeptic was forced to recant his views. Okay, so these proxy sittings refuted the idea that simple extrasensory perception or telepathy between medium and sitter was responsible for the accuracy of the communications. And that led to an extension of the simple telepathy theory into what became known as super ESP. And that's the idea that the medium subconsciously uses vast powers of telepathy and clairvoyance to gain information about the deceased. There are many different problems with that. I'm not entirely sure where to start. I mean, it took me a book.
I was going to say, good luck. Go ahead.
But that's why I've got the first section is called the toolkit. Part two is the evidence, and part three, I wrap it all up. But in the toolkit, I give the reader all the tools that they need to critically examine the evidence and skeptical objections. So I deal with things such as the nature of evidence, the various standards of proof beyond reasonable doubt versus proof beyond conceivable doubt. I deal with the extraordinary claims objection. I deal with the mind-body problem. I deal with the nature of science. What does it mean to refute a hypothesis? What is the difference in science, philosophy, and ideology? So I give the reader this toolkit in part one, and then we employ these tools to analyze both the evidence and the skeptical objections. In part two, in part three, we bring everything together and wrap it all up and make what I consider and many others consider to be a very strong case that the evidence for the afterlife proves beyond all reasonable doubts that we survive biological death or the change called death.
The thing I like that you include is the near-death experience and the out-of-body experiences, because I don't think you can talk about this without knowing some of the experiences and then figuring out the patterns, because there are similarities in some of the visions and some of the out-of-body things that they say that they've witnessed when the brain has been classified, qualified, quantified as being what we would consider dead. And you include experiences. And that, I think, that's crucial.
Yes, absolutely. Well, in my book, I consider five lines of evidence. Deathbed visions, the near-death experience, of course. Apparitions, children who claim to recall a previous life. And communication from the departed via human mediums. So these five independent lines of evidence are all very different from each other. And yet they all point in the same direction. And they're all explained by one simple and elegant explanation. The survival of the minds of the departed, period.
There's some quotes that you include. Einstein, stop telling God what to do.
And that was his friend Niels Bohr. Einstein remarked, God does not play dice. His friend Niels Bohr famously replied, Einstein, stop telling God what to do.
Do we have a clue what God does?
Perhaps provide us with his evidence, among other things. We can maybe make some tentative inferences, but that's about it.
The thing that you try to address is Christianity in some of this, saying that there is proof. This you know, this isn't a dead subject, so to speak. That we have in our history some kind of indication that there is life after death.
Well, in my prologue, I argue that Christianity is fully compatible, or the evidence, rather, is fully compatible with doctrines of Christianity. And I think that it can be argued that the earliest writing of the New Testament support this, and nothing, absolutely nothing, in the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth would contradict these ideas. And several theologians and clergymen fully support it. We talked about the Reverend Charles Drayton Thomas. I mentioned him with regards to the proxy sittings, mm-hmm. which he invented. He was a Methodist minister. For many years, he was an active member of the British Society for Psychical Research, and he participated in many sittings with many mediums. This is what he wrote. I'd like to read his words. Perhaps it will be asked what benefit may be expected from a general acceptance of this evidence for survival. I think it will do for others what it has done for me. It has supplemented and reinforced my faith, both in times of bereavement and in the prospect of old age and death. Also, it has further emphasized the value of personal religion.
You include animals. The fact that animals do see the deceased.
Yes, I think you're referring to my chapter in Apparition. There are several cases in which animals, dogs usually, do react to apparitions. Usually they react with alarm. the case of a dog running up what is believed to be an apparition, then as if, you know, looking to be petted, and then suddenly stopping and slinking away its tail between his legs. You know, yes, so animals do give every indication of reacting to the appearance of apparition, often before humans do, strangely enough.
Yeah, well, I've experienced that myself. So I it's nice to see that element also in your writing. What we're left with at the end is how important belief is. And I'm looking at the progress we're having right now with AI. And the fact that there are some huge, huge questions as to where our society is going to evolve. And if we are so stuck on the material presence, then where does that take us when we get into AI? Because that's a whole different animal, a whole different way of being and of life. And if we don't have something beyond, which is the non-physical form, then I think that leaves us a very quick exit. Where if we are non-physical, that brings us to another question of, well, how does that affect an AI body, an AI form?
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up. There's essentially two comments here. First of all, I don't like the term artificial intelligence. I think it's a misnomer. The better term is simulated intelligence. It's really nothing more than fancy programming. It's not genuine thinking. It doesn't do genuine analysis. It doesn't do genuine evaluation. It's simply incapable. All it does is it looks for patterns in the data that it's given, period. So it does have certain very practical uses, mostly in applications of medicine and applications of tutoring students in remote locations. Give you an example. you can take a machine, a computer, and feed it, for instance, I don't know, CAT scans. Well, the machine can analyze patterns in these CAT in thousands upon CAT scans in a matter of minutes and become very good at recognizing patterns that indicate the presence of a tumor, for instance. Now, the usual surgeon or specialist may see what? A few dozen, perhaps a few hundred CAT scans. So he, yes, he becomes better at it, identifying patterns, but the machine can examine thousands upon thousands of these CAT scans looking for patterns. So it can become a very useful tool to supplement the judgment of the physician. Not replace it, but supplement it. But that's not genuine thinking. That's just looking for patterns in data sets.
Processing.
Mechanical processing, fancy computer programming.
Yeah.
It's not going to replace humans. It's just another tool in our toolkit. And it has certain very powerful limited uses, such as, for example, analyzing medical data, huge quantities of medical data, because the computer can do things, simple things, much faster than a human being can do it. A human being cannot analyze thousands and thousands upon of medical scans within a few minutes. It's impossible. It requires a lifetime to analyze, you know, a few hundred. So it does have certain uses. It's not going to replace human beings. And again, the term artificial intelligence is a misnomer. The correct term should be simulated intelligence, because it's really just fancy programming. But you raised the second point. This research does have implications for our society. Why? Because it alters our individual behavior, a realization that we are not finite beings destined to live, 7, 8, 9 decades, what have you, but that our lives continue on after this. And this should change our definition of what it means to play the long game. I mean, let's face it, we're dumping 100 million tons of heat-trapping gases into our atmosphere every 24 hours. It's impossible. It boggles my mind, or anyone can think that we can do that, use the world's atmosphere and oceans and rivers as one huge garbage dump and not affect the climate. And we're seeing that right now in terms of increased severity of storms and what have you. The reason there's pushback against the climate scientists is because a lot of people have a vested interest in extracting and refining and selling fossil fuels. Now, some of these people, and I've talked to them, one argument that they'll give would be, why should you care, Chris? You're not going to be alive 50, 100 years from now. Why should you care? In other words, what they're thinking is, they think they're playing the long game. They think the game ends with their death, and they won't have to deal with the worst aspects of our pollution, our fossil fuel pollution. In other words, let the future generations deal with it. You know, we'll be gone. But that sort of short-term thinking, the definition of the long game should not be that the game ends with our death, therefore to hell with future generations. We should be thinking in terms rather of the game is not over with our death, the death of our bodies. In some ways, it's just beginning. And we will be held responsible for the sort of lives we lead here.
That's called reincarnation, and that brings in karma.
No, okay. I'm sorry, I disagree with that entirely.
Okay.
It has little to do with reincarnation. Some people have difficulty with the idea of reincarnation because the idea of endlessly coming back makes them uncomfortable. Well, as one of the, I think it was Geddes McGregor, he's a British theologian. I'm paraphrasing here.
Okay.
He says, if I fail to pass the examinations in this life, it seems reasonable I should come back and have to take the test again. But the evidence indicates not that we endlessly reincarnate. Most of us reincarnate 2 or 3 times, and that's it. Once the lessons worth life are learned, there's simply no reason to come back and repeat them. By the way, most of the cases that I've studied of people of children remember previous lives, they died prematurely in the previous life, often violently, usually in their 20s or 30s. So there seems to be a sense of unfinished business. But this has nothing to do with reincarnation. It has to do with our lives continue on after the deaths of our bodies. Whether we come back or not is irrelevant, and we will be held responsible for the choices we make here. So what I'm trying to say is the consideration of this sort of evidence to bring me back to my original point, it should change our definition of what it means to play the long game.
Okay, well, I want to go back at that when you're talking about reincarnation and the fact that it doesn't have to be endless. How are we held accountable?
The near-death experiencers, many of them will tell you that they encountered a being of light on the other side who led them through a life review, going back as far as they can remember to their early childhood, and showing them the major events of their lives. And often these major events were not what you and I would consider major events, but they were shown the effects of their actions on other people, and often made to experience, for good or for bad, the reactions of other people to how they treated these other people or how they treated others in general. It seems to be not a case of that we're judged by some external being, but we're forced to judge ourselves. This is usually, the near-death experience is usually considered to be, by those who experience it, the single most important and pivotal events of their lives. They come back changed. In many cases, they have a greater sense of compassion, a greater sense of responsibility to others, to the planet, and most notably, a greatly reduced fear of death and a greatly increased conviction that biological death is not the end, and we go on, our lives continue in other realms.
Are there ways that we can connect with that other realm while we're alive, aside from a near-death experience?
Well, some people would say prayer, and I certainly do not write that off. I think that's important. I have an entire chapter on communication via human mediums from the departed. That I consider to be the single most convincing line of evidence of the five lines that I've discussed. So, yeah, I do think that there has been and continues to be sporadic contact with the other side.
If a soul, someone who is, someone who is present without a physical form, if that is a reality, could that impact what we are right now trying to create in terms of robots and other forms of being without requiring a physical form? I guess I'm getting into the folks who are storing their bodies and their brains and hoping that something happens with that. Do you think that's actually something that could exist in the future? I mean, this isn't in your book. This is just your beliefs and all of the things that you have studied in terms of the presence, the being of a body, a form versus a soul or a non-physical form. And if that exists, and sometimes it can influence people, why couldn't it influence a robot or something that is what we consider electric? Because the body is also electric. So I'm asking you, in your own philosophy, your idea of whatever it takes to be a human, a being, if that's possible that we could actually experience in another form and not have to worry about the physical body, but have the soul in another form. Does that make sense?
I understand what you're saying. Your question makes sense. I don't think the idea makes any sense at all. I don't think that our beings are machines. I don't think that human beings are machines. I don't think that the brain produces the mind. I don't think that our consciousness can be stored anyway. I don't think that people will be resuscitated 1,000 or 1,000,000 years from now. If you're talking about cryogenics, you're talking about the idea that maybe we can upload our consciousness to machines. These people are grasping at straws. The reason they're grasping at straws is because they start off from a false premise, which is the premise that the mind is produced by the brain, and that the brain is somehow some sort of biological computer which is responsible for the mind. The surgeon Wilder Penfield, he won the Nobel Prize for his work. He basically worked with epileptic patients, stimulating the brains with electrodes and bringing back memories and so forth. He considered the relationship between, or he was led, he was driven by his research to the conclusion that the relationship between the mind and the brain is that of programmer to computer. In other words, the brain is a sort of biological computer which is programmed by the mind, but the mind is independent of the brain. And we see this all the time. All of us program our brains. We've often had the experience that we get into our car on a Saturday and we're thinking about something else. We find ourselves driving towards work. Why? Because we've programmed our brain to do that. So we can do these things automatically, freeing up our minds to think about other things. So although I think there's a sense in which the brain is a biological computer, I don't think that the brain is a computer in the same sense that my laptop is a brain, or that my brain is a machine similar to my laptop. The two are extremely different. All a computer does is go through very simple steps very rapidly. And that's very powerful. It's a powerful tool that we can use, but we have to remember it's just that. It's a tool. It's another tool in our kit, along with screwdrivers and hammers and saws and power saws and automobiles and what have you. So, again, I don't know what else to say about this.
Let me go a different direction. Yeah. All right. So we're talking about EVP, or we're talking about something that can influence an electronic, like a phone. When somebody gets a phone call, and that's phone calls from the dead. All right. That is an independent mind, an independent intelligence outside of a body, outside of a human form, able to influence our technology. So my question is, if consciousness is not stuck in a brain, could it independently occupy or influence something that is made to be a receptacle for human mind, human thought, human insight? That's my question.
That's beyond the scope of my book because, as I said, I consider five independent lines of evidence. I did not consider what are called electronic communication or EBV, electronic voice phenomena, what have you, including what are called phone calls from the dead. Some of this evidence is very interesting and compelling, but I don't consider it because I wanted to only consider the evidence which simply is the most difficult to explain away in terms of fraud or mistaken perception or what have you. That sort of evidence is simply beyond the scope of my book.
I think you need another book because you think about these things. You consider all the angles and you find the science, okay? So I like what you have in this book. I like the fact that it's very concrete and you give people the tools they need because there is still a lot of ignorance in terms of the fact that we do exist beyond the physical form. And there's just so much pushback and decades of pushback and fear. Why we don't want to get beyond that, I don't know.
Remember that in my book, I've got six appendices, and the third appendice is simply titled, Why Does What We Believe Matter? And we touched on this earlier. Yes, I think that we're at a crucial juncture in our civilization. I think we face an existential crisis right now in terms of climate change. This problem is not going to go away. We're not dealing with it sufficiently. And we need to take strong action, and take strong action very soon before our climate reaches various tipping points, in which case all bets are off. So I think that what we believe most certainly is extremely important. And I also think that the evidence completely refutes the atheistic and materialistic idea that death means extinction. I think death is an illusion.
I agree. And that's personal experience for me. What I like at the end of their book, when you talk about the appendix, The Growth of Spirit, and this is Judge David Patterson Hatch in his communications and talking about what would happen in the afterlife. And at one point, what he's saying is that we're all capable of becoming what in our mind as humans we would refer to as gods. And so in other words, this is all about progressing and expanding, evolving. And right now that what we're doing is evolving.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Jesus of Nazareth said it himself to his disciples, you are gods. And David Patterson Hatch actually seems to have postmortemly quoted those words of Jesus right after describing what you just said, that a man is capable of becoming of what men once called gods. The purpose of life, this life and the life, the next life, seems to be the development of the mind, or the soul, I should say, the development of the person. We're not here to stagnate. We're not here to just accumulate wealth, as much as many toys as we can. We're here to grow and develop. And this process does not end at the death of our lives. If we fail to pass the examinations that we're required to pass in this life, it makes sense that we may have to repeat them. In other words, come back. But once we've learned the lessons of this life, there's simply no reason to repeat them, and we're free to go on and continue to develop and grow in other realms, eventually becoming, as Hatch said, if we apply ourselves, capable of becoming what men once called gods.
Of all the people that you've studied, what case can you offer as a proof, one standout case, that life goes on, that there is an afterlife?
Well, the case is cumulative. It's sort of like a case put on by murder, during a murder trial. I mean, there's various types of evidence, and the more evidence that the prosecutor can present, the more convincing his case. That's why I present evidence from five independent lines of evidence. So a prosecutor will present forensic evidence, eyewitness evidence, circumstantial evidence, and so forth. And these work together, reinforce each other to make a cumulative case beyond reasonable doubt, never beyond all conceivable doubt. That's an impossible standard to meet when dealing with factual matters. As I mentioned earlier, I do think the single most impressive line of evidence would be communication via mediums. And I also mentioned that after the original members of the British and American Society's psychical research began to die off, messages purporting to come from them were received. Particularly impressive to me are the messages received by the British researcher and classical scholar Frederick Myers. I mentioned several of the cases that he seems to put forward in my book. I don't think we have time to discuss these in depth because some of them are rather lengthy, but I think they're well worth the study, and I tried to present them as clearly and convincingly as I possibly could.
The case for the afterlife. To wrap up, you are very diligent in trying to cover all the bases. What's next on the list? What? Because obviously this is still a big, I think, issue for us as we go forward and with AI entering into the equation. So what's next?
I have to admit, I don't understand the question. And again, I don't use the term AI, I use the term SI, simulated intelligence. I don't think AI has anything to do with this issue at all.
With simulated intelligence, do you see us going forward in determining, how that factors into our future, along with the fact that maybe we need to be more focused on there is an afterlife and not just write it all off and say the world ends tomorrow, so no big deal?
I think the computer programming, fancy as it though may it be, is completely irrelevant as to the question of whwhether or not we survive and the validity of the evidence. I mean, it's the old programmer's saying, garbage in, garbage out. If you feed a simulated intelligence engine with garbage, and then it's going to give you garbage conclusions. It's essentially useless in any sort of evaluating any sort of controversial issue, including this one, because the answer that you get determines upon what data you give it. And again, it's not genuine thinking. It's simulated intelligence. It is genuine intelligence is capable of analysis, synthesis, and most crucially, evaluation. And the one thing that a machine cannot do is evaluate information. It cannot take contradictory data and evaluate and say, well, this person says this person says that. So instead, it'll give you a wishy-washy answer like, there are arguments on both sides, and it today remains essentially unsettled. Garbage in, garbage out. I don't think that AI or simulated intelligence, SI, is of any way relevant to this issue.
Okay. You've answered my question. Your next case that you're going to investigate, do you have one?
Well, I'm not a field investigator myself. I write from the perspective of philosopher of science and mind. So, no, I'm not a field researcher.
What makes you curious?
Curious about what?
About the afterlife.
Well, I think I wouldn't be human if I wasn't curious about the afterlife. I think everybody asks themselves these questions. It's how we answer them that makes the crucial distinction. Do we just follow whatever we were taught in church, or do we have a more critical bent? Do we rebel against what we were taught by our parents, what we were taught in church, and become militant atheists, which many people do, or some people do at least? Or do we use those things as a starting point and then critically examine, search for, and critically examine all the available evidence that we can find? That is what I think that I've done. And I don't think it's necessary for those of us who accept the reality of the afterlife to hesitate or to take refuge in the mysteries of faith. I think that modern revelation fully supports and supplements the words of the ancients. Again, the evidence is vast, varied, and ancient, and fully supports the case for the afterlife.
I like the intro to the book. James Hyslop, is that how you pronounce it?
Oh, yeah.
That was my favorite part.
Would you like me to read it?
Yeah. Yes, I love it.
Okay, here it is. I regard the existence of discarnate spirits as scientifically proved, and I no longer refer to the skeptic as having any right to speak on the subject. Any man who does not accept the existence of discarnate spirits and the proof of it is either ignorant or a moral coward. I give him short shrift and do not propose any longer to argue with him on the supposition that he knows anything about the subject. James Hyslop, Professor of Logic and Ethics, General Secretary of the American Society for Psychical Research, 1905-1920.
See, that's outstanding. It says this has been an issue that was resolved and supposedly case closed, and still we're having to have this discussion. All right, I like the fact that you lived in a haunted house, because not everybody would be up to that challenge depending on the nature of their sensitivity. So kudos.
Thank you.
That was one way to get started and launch basically your career. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for having me, Wendy.